What are museums for? Whose stories do they tell? How do they decide which aspects of the past to preserve and represent?
I'm Luke Syson, Director of the Fitzwilliam Museum at the University of Cambridge.
And I'm Nicola Jennings, Director of the Athena Art Foundation.
And over the course of six conversations, we're inviting a range of cultural figures, from directors and curators and researchers to activists and writers, to share their thoughts on the role of the museum in the 21st century.
We'll be looking at the modern museum through a variety of lenses, exploring some of the key questions museums around the world are currently asking themselves. How can museums represent the diverse communities they serve? To whom do cultural artifacts and their narratives belong? What role can digital technologies play? How can museums work sustainably to preserve our futures as well as our pasts?
Of all the huge issues the world faces now, the rescue of the planet feels for many to be the most urgent. Thankfully, there are more and more passionate campaigners, but I still think it's an area where, faced with decisions by nations at large international gatherings, a lot of us still feel peculiarly helpless. So what, if anything, can museums really achieve? We're a relative small fry, after all, on the world stage. And should our efforts be about national, local, or international actions and participations? What might the different roles of the art and science museums be? What should we be doing?
I'm going to introduce our guests. We're delighted to have Rebecca Kilner. Rebecca has been Professor of Evolutionary Biology in the Department of Zoology at the University of Cambridge since 2013 and Director of the University's Museum of Zoology since 2019. She also co-leads with a new strategic research initiative within Cambridge University that will facilitate and promote interdisciplinary approaches to tackling key societal challenges using collections-based research. Rebecca was elected a Fellow of the Royal Society in 2021. Our other guest is Esme Ward. Esme is Director of Manchester Museum and Honorary Professor of Heritage Futures at the University of Manchester. She's the Environmental Sustainability Lead for the Manchester Cultural Leaders Group and Chair of the Culture, Health and Wellbeing Alliance. And she sits on the National Museum's Directors Executive Council. So welcome to both of you. Becky?
Should museums be advocating more openly for action around climate change and other threats to the environment?
I would say yes, and I think my answer is informed by asking two further questions. Who do we serve and what is our purpose? In university museums, I think we serve the university by serving the public, and at the moment the public includes our local communities and the global audiences that we reach digitally. And our purpose is to educate and possibly entertain so as to be able to engage minds in critical thought. So I think we exist to give people the tools to question the world in which they live and to make informed choices about the kind of society and the kind of world that they want to live in and what it will take to make that happen. So we are the antidote to fake news, to populism, to complex problems presented as simplistic binary choices. And it's really instructive to look at indices of who people trust at the moment. In an Ipsos Mori Index of Trust from 2020, professors, scientists, and museum curators all have very high scores of trust. So they score more than 80%. And at the bottom of the table, with scores of less than 25%, are journalists, politicians generally, and advertising executives. But which of these voices has the greatest capacity to dominate public discourse and influence opinions? Spoiler alert, it's not the professors, the scientists, and the museum curators. So if now isn't the time to amplify our voices and to do something, then I don't know when will be. And I think we have a duty to contribute to public debates, to put facts and evidence-based opinions and options out there in the public domain. And that will seem like activism, but if we don't do it, then who will?
Esme, do you feel that museums should be acting more openly and being activists in this area?
So I suppose for me, this is all around the role of museums building empathy, understanding, I would argue, love for our world and each other. In a university museum context, I think we have an extraordinary power to convene for many of the reasons that Becky's already mentioned. You know, there are still so few public spaces where you bring generations together to have really open conversations. And I think how we not just convene, but also mobilize and equip people to navigate the worlds in which we live, the future we face, absolutely sits at the heart of this. And I think this sense of that space between engagement and activism, I mean, ultimately, activism means you're motivated to lead change. So actually, museums have always done that. We have always supported people, whether that's around storytelling, story making, whether that's around the evidence we hold within our collections, whether that's around the people we work with. We've always been spaces to explore big, complex ideas. My museum, Manchester Museum, has got a mission to build a more sustainable world. If we're not doing this, quite simply, we're not fulfilling our mission.
Can we push that one step further? I mean, should museums be seeking to influence governments and teaching people how they can actually make changes to their lives? Esme, you want to come back on that?
Yeah, well, I suppose it sort of depends government at what level. Somebody wrote to me when I became director here in 2018, complaining about the state of rubbish collection in Moss Side, which is a local neighbourhood to my museum. And we've been doing a lot of work collecting and telling stories about particularly the impacts of plastic. But actually, they were really frustrated by lack of awareness about recycling and the state of rubbish collection. So over a few months and conversations with them, and they worked with archaeologists, they work with staff at the museum, they work with artists, they work with others. We essentially developed what became a rubbish night at the museum. It was an exhibition, it was artwork, and we literally had residents and waste professionals and policymakers and students, and we brought all of them together to build an agenda for action. And we told stories and we started to explore some of the issues around the impact of not recycling. And for me, it was a real light bulb moment, because actually that same activist who'd written me that original email got in touch with me afterwards and said, I have been trying to get hold of Andy Burnham and some of his team for nearly 2 years. Who knew the way to do this was to host a rubbish night at the museum? And so it depends what we think influence looks like. That's everything from lobbying through to being really frank, the conversation a mother and her kids has in our galleries. It's influence at all those levels. So absolutely, I think we should be there both sharing those stories, telling those stories, but also really thinking how we've got the ability to bring people together to think differently about what the future might look like.
What about you, Becky? As a museum of zoology, you must have a huge role to play in highlighting issues like extinction.
So I think we serve an important role by starting with individuals who will then, hopefully informed by the kind of work that we put on, will care enough to start lobbying their politicians and policymakers who can start to make a change at a higher level. And there are three practical ways that we do that in our galleries. So the first message that you see straight away as soon as you walk into the galleries is extinction is real. The first animal pretty much that you meet eyeball to eyeball as you come into the gallery is a dodo. So if you don't get the message from that straight away, I don't know how you will, but if you go downstairs, you'll meet a giant ground sloth, which hopefully you'll never meet in real life, and you'll also meet the extinct moa, and you'll see the extinct elephant bird's giant egg. So extinction is everywhere in the galleries. You can't escape it. When you see these animals from the past like that, it's easy to think, well, that happened then, it doesn't happen now. So a second strand of our work is to convince people that familiar animals from their everyday lives face extinction threats. And one way we did that this summer was with an exhibition that intertwined the natural world with ceramics. It was called Breaking Point. And we had a particularly emotive installation by an artist called Jane Iveamy, who had made the 70 birds that are on the British Red List. So these are birds that are threatened or critically endangered out of ceramics, and positioned them in their white form against a black background with a tag tied around their toe, like so many bodies laid out in a mortuary. And every so often interspersed among these ceramics were skins from our collections representing one of these 70 birds. These are animals that we see in our gardens that are about to go. And we had a very strong emotional reaction to that from people that were visiting the gallery, describing they had tears in their eyes, they had felt the hairs on the back of their neck stand up on end. It was a much more emotive way of displaying the bald facts of the kind of extinction threat that our birds are facing now than I've ever seen. And then the third way we do this every year, we have something called the Earth Optimism Event, which is organised by the Cambridge Conservation Institute, which is our next door neighbour. And they bring in lots of people from around the world to give talks about how conservation practice can make a real difference. Part of that is an event called the Solutions Fair, which operates in our Whale Hall in the museum. And this is lots of practical ways in which people can make small changes to their everyday lives to live more sustainably. Simple things like changing how they shop, changing what temperature they run their washing machine at, or what temperature they keep their central heating dial at, and try and prevent disasters like extinction from happening. And if we start to get people to care at that level and lobby hard, then things will start to change at a higher level as well.
Yeah, it's that lobbying hard which is really important, isn't it? Because government would like us to believe that it's all about our individual actions, and of course it is, but it's the structural stuff that's really going to make the big difference, isn't it?
Yeah.
Can I just pick up on something there? Becky's just mentioned the word a few times, actually, and I think it's really critical here. It's the word care. And thinking about what does that mean, actually, to really reframe how we care and take action? And what does that mean for us as not just a museum, but actually as a city? How do we behave in a way that is genuinely useful to our city? And the minute we've started to think about what we need to do to be more useful in terms of this collective care, actually, it's changing everything. So our entire top floor is being transformed. It's opened up. It's now a co-working hub for environmental charities and educational charities. Essentially share our mission and vision. And they are climate activists. They are researchers. They are the Carbon Literacy Project. They are ecologists. And they're using the collections in whatever way possible to both support their work, but also to start thinking about those solutions. And when I've spoken to them about why do you want to do this with the museum, what they've said is actually because we've got to start thinking about how we connect people emotionally. Exactly as we've just heard, it's about those emotional connections. And a group of students developed this extraordinary guide called the Student Guide to the Climate Crisis, but really it was about climate grief and action and how hope exists in the actions we can all collectively take. So you really start to move away from that sense of kind of individual burden, particularly on young people, and start to think about how collectively we can find a way forwards together.
Most interesting things in the examples you've both given is that kind of pricking of conscience. We dedicated another podcast to thinking about the legacies of enslavement and empire. And one of the great tactics that the abolitionists used at the beginning of the 19th century was punctuating a kind of collective obliviousness or blinkeredness in some ways by visual means, performance, works of art, as well as narrative. And it strikes me that one of the tactics that's not being, perhaps being used enough at the moment by environmental campaigners is visual. And so Esme, can I ask you about works of art in this story?
Yeah, I'm sort of in two minds on this one as well. So it's interesting. Yes, absolutely, the visual. And I can see, you know, some extraordinary visual artists doing really brilliant work out there. I've actually got much, much more interested in the more experiential, because when we're talking about that emotional connectedness, I think it's where it really starts to open up. So a couple of examples that have really resonated recently. One is Totem Latemat, which was created by a Totonac Nation artist called Yun Tibertio, was commissioned through Border Crossings Origins Festival and actually stopped in Manchester as part of a broader journey all the way from Mexico to Glasgow for COP. Absolutely stunning, huge totem pole. It was directly opposite the museum. Latemat means life. And so it was this really quite beautiful introduction to people to think about how deeply our existence is interwoven with nature, and an invitation almost to rethink our relationships and the storytelling and conversations that happened around this totem were the point. And those were so fascinating because they were members of the public, they were beyond the museum walls. But for me, that was a really beautiful example, very visually stunning, but also really getting people to think from new perspectives. So in this case, aligned with some of our other work, this is very clearly thinking from Indigenous perspectives, thinking about our relationship with the land. The other example, which really resonates, is around sound, really experimenting with sound. So everything from last year, working with a brilliant sound artist who was recording and composing field recordings of nature and sonified weather pattern data sets just at the moment of lockdown, a beautiful piece called Wild Chorus, thinking about a kind of reawakening our sense of the natural world and our connectedness to it, through to most recently a new piece called Planet People Power, working with two brilliant artists called Farah Ahmed Khan and Balraj Singh Samrai. And it was music really exploring climate change and environmental inequality in relation to South Asian diaspora communities, placing their voices at the heart of a sonic piece. And the reason I'm so interested in those is because actually what we found is they open up conversations and we can use them in such a broad range of contexts. You know, the Planet People Power was on Marianne Hobbs' show on Radio 6. You know, it can be used in all these different forms. So I love the visual. I think there's huge scope in the visual. But I'll be honest, the thing that's sort of making our hearts beat faster at the moment and seems to be really opening up conversations and that emotional connectedness are the things that are a little bit more experiential than solely visual.
Becky, you talked already about a ceramics project. I'm interested, as you're now thinking about how the collections in Cambridge might work across disciplines, how your own thinking around the role of works of art has developed in this last few months and years.
Yeah, I think it's important to have art alongside natural science collections because art brings an emotional connectedness that the natural science collections don't in themselves articulate to our audiences. So you can have a very strong response to something you might see in a natural science collection, but you can't explain to yourself why you're feeling that. But an art piece that goes alongside it can help provide that narrative and help explain why you're reacting so strongly. So I think there's a very important role for art to serve there. The other thing I'd like to pick up on that Esme just said is that we also are thinking about using sound and alternative realities or virtual realities to reanimate the many dead things that are populating our galleries, to bring them back to life. Because I think by making the animals seem real again, that's another way of re-establishing an emotional connection and signifying what we might lose if they were to go extinct. But also because I think that by seeing the natural world, we as humans, we're part of that, and we don't live our lives as though we're part of that normally in the Western world. And that is to our immense disadvantage, not only emotionally, but for our mental health and well-being. And that by realising how much we will lose for ourselves if the natural world was to go into catastrophic decline, because of the substantial nurturing value it gives us, I think that can help people care and want to do more as well.
I think that's very interesting. I was very struck when I learned not very long ago the poplars in Monet's famous series of paintings were preserved temporarily by Monet from being chopped up to be made into matchsticks. When he'd finished painting them, they were chopped down. That suddenly gives a very different resonance to landscape painting from the past. And I think it does two things. One is that it reminds you that sometimes that solace of nature can be transferred unhelpfully to art, and that we allow a certain kind of framing of the natural world to occur if we're not careful, and sort of see it as a separate thing from our existence. But the other, I think, is around a history of long-term investigation of our environment that can be scientific and sometimes can be aesthetic, and in both cases can be emotional in ways that we don't always understand. So my next question to both of you, but perhaps beginning with Becky, is how do the ways in which people have studied nature in the past help us now? Are they still relevant, or should we only really be looking at the now and the future?
I think the way that people studied and collected in the past is absolutely vital for what we do now. And the reason is because if we study what's around us right now, we don't have any information about what happened in the past. So the beauty of natural history, natural science collections is that they bear an imprint of the past. They're a record of what we used to have that we can compare with now and see what we don't have. We have a very nice example of this in the Museum of Zoology in Cambridge, where we have a fantastic British butterfly collection, which was assembled by Jennings, famous for saying no to going on the voyage of the Beagle. So some other known chap called Darwin went in his place. And Jennings stayed behind as vicar of Bottisham and collected butterflies 200 years ago. And what his butterfly collection tells us is that species of butterfly like the large copper and the swallowtail, which are currently extinct in Cambridgeshire, were actually quite abundant back then. And by correlating their decline with changes in the landscape, Ed Turner, who's the curator of insects in the museum and his research group, have been able to deduce that their decline is associated with the draining of the wetlands. And this knowledge is now being used to help rewild the Great Fen, this enormous conservation and wildlife restoration project that's going on in the north of Cambridgeshire. And we can do more and more of this work informed directly by information from our collections. It's a data vault of history of life on Earth that we can use to understand what makes populations resilient, what prevents them from going extinct. And then that can help us identify which communities, which ecosystems, which species are vulnerable to extinction now and act to intervene to prevent them from going extinct. And we wouldn't have any of that information were it not for the natural science collections in our possession.
Yeah, I really love that. You know, we've been thinking about the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, particularly in urban contexts, and our collections hold all these other narratives. So anyone who knows me well knows my minor obsession with an incredible naturalist called Leopold Grindon, who gave a whole host of his herbaria collections to Manchester Museum. Just earlier, I was meeting with colleagues about Manchester's new biodiversity strategy for the future. Actually, it was the biodiversity of the early 20th century, late 19th century Manchester flora. It is all there. There's so much there that we can draw upon now. And those stories are really, really powerful, not just as an understanding of where we've come from, but really informing where we are. So I'm in an office with a huge painting of a peppered moth, one of the kind of best examples of showing the impact of pollution, informing all of our work moving forwards about measuring air quality and how we're supporting schools to measure the air quality on their doorstep and understand the impact of air quality, not just on lives now, but on lives of the past. I suppose it's also who was studying nature and what of that we get to see. So, you know, one of the really fascinating things of the last really 18 months has been starting to work much more with Indigenous communities. We have a curator of Indigenous perspective, and starting to really bring those perspectives to our core scientific data. And that really does start to open up our thinking about these collections and how we understand them. And it does feel like everyone in the world at the moment is ready for a bigger conversation about what we understand nature to constitute and how we might view ourselves as part of it.
I think that sense of place is absolutely crucial. And one of the things I learned recently was that Constable painted Constable Country from footpaths. That extraordinary right that we have to roam our own countryside and to experience it in all the ways that we did. But it's also a story of what kind of land he was excluded from, what he was looking at from afar. And understanding Constable as a naturalist and as an investigation of, indeed, an Indigenous culture is a really interesting thing, that relationship between people and place. I think Becky wants to come in.
I just want to make the counter-argument to the argument I advanced so forcefully a moment ago, which is that although natural science collections are a treasure trove of data about the past, they obviously are biased. We shouldn't take them to be a direct readout of everything that was in the natural world at that point. Jack Ashby, who's the assistant director of the Zoology Museum in Cambridge, has done some brilliant work pointing out that they're biased towards the eye-catching, the larger animals and the freaks, and they're balanced towards countries that, in our collections anyway, that used to be part of the British Empire. So we have to be careful in the interpretations that we draw, but nevertheless, used in the correct way with our eyes wide open, they are a rich source of information about our past.
And that's part of the problematizing where we are now as well, though. That's part of that opening up the conversation, thinking about what it means to have a decolonial lens in terms of looking at this, bringing other perspectives in, thinking about those other inclusive approaches to our collections. Actually, they're hugely problematic. And Manchester Museum is absolutely an institution born of empire. Our South Asia Gallery, when it opens, will have one whole section which is specifically about this and this sense of us compartmentalising the natural world and essentially a really extractive approach to nature.
Can we change the focus a little bit now? Can we actually talk about what museums themselves are doing to become more sustainable? Because I think that's another part of the whole question. Esme?
I think museums are doing a lot, some more than others, but I think this is now well and truly on the radar. The bins and the light bulbs, they're really important, but we should be doing all of that anyway. So of course there are things we can do, whether that's around thinking about how you might want to start decarbonising, whether you want to look at all of your practices. In our case, we're doing a lot of work around what a more circular economy looks like, whether that's around our sustainable products in our shop, around waste, all of those areas, not least exhibition making, recycling, reuse, touring, implications of touring. The practice, the day-to-day practice of museums, I think all of that to me is absolutely up for grabs. And if you're in a museum like mine and your mission is to build a more sustainable world, you actually need to start really looking at the systems and the structures that you are working within. But, and there is a but for me, there is something around the work, I think, which is foundational that needs to happen to actually really enable that work to be meaningful. We're the world's first carbon literate museum. We have the brilliant Carbon Literacy Project based in Manchester. And we have a new programme funded by Arts Council called Roots and Branches. So we have a carbon literacy trainer within the museum staff, and all staff have indeed been trained to be carbon literate. But they're also working to support the wider museum sector, so any museum in the UK, to become more carbon literate. And I think for me, there's something around the what are you doing collectively to equip you and all of your staff to really start to grapple with the differences you can make and really thinking about where the impact is most powerful in terms of those differences. So we have a Greening the Museum group. They're a cross sector group and they feed directly into the strategic decisions made around where the money goes, so that we've always got that voice in the room thinking about the environmental impact of our work, and that becoming more and more one of the things that helps us make the right decisions for our future. We're not there yet. We're grappling with how it works, but it feels really, really important. Even to get there, we've had to actually do a lot of work across all the staff and volunteers and have a kind of collective conversation about the differences across all of our work that we can make. And I think it will lead to some quite major decisions, not least about things like touring internationally and some of the bigger decisions we make about the impact that we have environmentally. This doesn't just sit within one part of the organisation. For me, this is a leadership issue. It is also a holistic museum-wide issue, and it is everyone's work.
No, I don't think there's any territory left untapped there. So the only thing I would say is that we're a much different scale of organisation. So we're embedded within a department which is embedded in a university. So the collective larger scale actions are happening at the university level. But the general principle is, yes, we absolutely have to practice what we preach. And we especially have to do that if we're working so closely with conservation organisations. It would be absolutely hypocritical to anything else.
It's exciting, though. This is the land of possibility here. So it absolutely means giving stuff up. It really does. But actually, in giving that stuff up, there are going to be so many new forms of partnership working. The future's collaborative. So if you take something like touring exhibitions, there's something called Magnet Emerge at the beginning of lockdown, actually, in part driven by this. And it's regional museums of a certain size thinking about how they can work together collectively, how they can tour across all of their sites. And actually, the environmental impact will, done right, be significantly less. And actually, it will create new opportunities. To me, it feels like this real moment, potentially a tipping point, but it is going to need some, I don't even know whether it's bravery. I think it's just us stepping up and stopping doing things and leaving some forms of behaviour behind. It feels now is the time to do that.
Yeah, I think we've had so many cultural changes in the way that we work in the last 18 months that this is the perfect time to enact another cultural change on this front.
Okay, so another cultural change, another key one, is that world of digital. Is there a particular strand of virtual digital activity that museums ought to be doing? And why would we be the best people to do that work rather than, say, the Royal Society or another organisation without a collection? I think it's Esme's turn.
Digital is really interesting, and this is unresolved for me. One of the things that I and others really value around the digital is actually something that Becky spoke about at the beginning, which is the relationship between the local and the global. So there is absolutely no doubt that you are able to now digitally engage with a whole host of partners and others to bring those to the heart of local conversations. So we have a vivarium, a live animal collection. We do a lot of species conservation. We work with Indigenous communities in South America. Actually, when I look at the work that we've done connecting classrooms in Manchester with classrooms in South America and those young people, that is the most wonderful use to me of digital and really bringing them together to have essentially a collective conversation about what care of your backyard looks like. It's hugely powerful. So I think digital, there's so much potential there. The bit that's really unresolved for me is what the environmental impact of that digital work is. I don't feel we measure it. I don't think we know how to measure it. A colleague of mine has just been developing an NFT. My gut feeling is NFTs absolutely have such huge environmental impact. They would absolutely not be right for my organisation and for our mission. But at the moment, the environmental impact doesn't seem to be featuring in that conversation. I would love to understand more what the impact of some of our digital work is in terms of our environmental and certainly our carbon use as well. And I say that as someone who is not keen on offsetting as a kind of neat solution. But the potential to have those kind of global conversations, I think, is extraordinary and will connect people to the natural world in ways we haven't even imagined.
I'm also experiencing a bit of tension and conflicting views about this, but for, I think, for slightly different reasons. So the first is that one of the biggest surprises in the aftermath of when we were closed, thanks to the pandemic, was just how much people matter to museums and how important it is to have real people coming in to see real objects. And there's no substitute for that. I really hope we never get to a place where we just exist entirely online, because I don't think that serves our purpose at all. And partly it's because of the shared experience of the joy and thrill of seeing objects that are outside our everyday experience and as feeling part of a community that's experiencing that collectively. That's the downside to me of digital, that there's a temptation to think that we can move entirely into that sphere and give up on our more traditional ways of engaging with audiences. The thing that excites me about digital, counterbalanced by all the caveats about the environmental impact, of course, is that I think for the natural science collections, this is an extremely rich vein to be tapped in future research. There's so many hidden things that we can find and discover with our collections using digital techniques, reanimating the extinct, making the 2D into 3D, reconstructing ecological communities, looking at the fine detail and internal structures of our specimens. I think these are the really exciting areas for future research using our collected material. But exactly how much damage that will do to the environment with all the high power technology that will be required. Like Esme, I don't know how those two things sit alongside each other.
A last question, and it's probably one of the trickiest questions, which is about sponsorship from companies which are responsible for environmental degradation. I mean, this has become a huge issue for a number of major museums. Fundraising is difficult. Fundraising for exhibitions is very difficult. So how do we get around this problem?
So we've been really thinking about what an ethics of care means for us as an organisation. The care, you know, you have for your collections, you know, extend that sense of care to people, to ideas, to beliefs and relationships. And it's in the relationship bit for me that this question sits. So actually, I don't find this a particularly difficult question in the sense that actually what we do is we look at the alignment of values. We look at the alignment of our mission. We would not accept sponsorship from oil companies. It's really straightforward for us. If we have a sense that there is greenwashing, we have those conversations. It's about us trying to be, at every turn, less transactional, more relational in what we do. This actually opens up new possibilities. This opens up new relationships. You know, maybe that model, the old-fashioned model of sponsor the exhibition, maybe that's not it anymore. Maybe it's that actually you find someone who's really aligned with your values and your mission, and the exhibition is just one of the many ways in which you achieve that. So we, as part of the University of Manchester, frame a lot of our work in terms of the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And they're really interesting because they give you a different lens through which to view your mission and to start to have a very different kind of conversation with a range of funders, philanthropists, organizations. If anything they are doing is failing to meet our mission, then actually it isn't appropriate for us to take financial support from them. I may be a bit black and white on this, but I really do think it is as simple as that. So it's starting to think instead about how do we start to build relationships and build support and actually build community around a whole host of people. There are some extraordinary companies and individuals out there who really want to support the kind of work we're doing. It's on us to build those relationships.
Yes, I have two things to add to that. I very much agree with everything Esme's said. One of the most important things in thinking about this is to be clear about the relationships that we have with outside organisations to our public, because one of our most important commodities is that we are trusted. And if we erode that trust by entering into alliances with people or organisations whose values don't align with ours, as Esme was saying, then that prevents us from having any voice of reason in public debates. And you can see how much that matters at the moment by looking at how hard some portions of the media are trying to erode trust in organisations that we traditionally have trusted, like the BBC, like the NHS, like the National Trust or the RSPB. They're all valued for being trustable and they're all under assault at the moment. I do think there is perhaps more grey in this argument. What about if we would like a newspaper whose values are not aligned with ours to publicise some of our work? So what if one of the tabloids whose views we don't find palatable most of the time wants to run a large splash on an exhibition on sustainability? That would be brilliant in some senses because it would reach audiences that we don't traditionally reach and we bring them into the space where we're trying to hold a conversation. It's not as straightforward as the question surrounding a financial transaction, but I think it touches on the same kinds of problems of where we draw the line of who we engage with. And we have to be a little bit careful about how we draw that line and how we're cutting out audiences, perhaps in some cases, by doing that.
But I think even the financial relationships are not straightforward, because when you think of the larger museums, I mean, like the British Museum and the Science Museum and the National Gallery and the Tate, they are big beasts, big tankers, and it takes a long time to turn those ships around. And they program these exhibitions several years ahead, and finding funding to step in is very difficult. So I have some sympathy for them. I can see why activists are very, very angry, but it is going to take a bit of time to change the model. I'm really intrigued by what you say, Esme, about coming up with a new model for not investing everything in the big exhibition, but thinking about different ways of showing things and creating events.
I mean, it interests me because I do think the big beasts show that change can happen. Tate, it was a few years ago, but they divested fully and no longer take sponsorship. And they have worked really, really hard to build other relationships. I suppose partly where I'm interested in it is I love exhibitions, I really do, but they are only part of what we do. And so actually, if you start thinking about the way that you build relationships, whether that's with philanthropists, whether it's with organisations, funders, really engaging them with your core mission, with all of your work, that creates more and more possibilities. What I'm interested in is bringing all of us to that conversation. conversation with those individuals. Extraordinary work with young people. We haven't even talked about education for future survival and the work we're doing around the curriculum and how we shift it. It might be that actually that's as much interest to some of those funders as that exhibition. I don't think it's an either or. I think it's going to take a while, but I think we also need to be really intentional about it. And it might mean that we just stop doing quite so many big blockbusters. You know, maybe the world can cope with that.
And perhaps we have to accept that we don't have much time. And on that note, I'd like to say a huge thank you to Jasmine Ward and Rebecca Kilner, to Becky, my colleague in Cambridge.
Thank you both so much. That was a wonderful conversation. I think people are going to be listening to that with great interest because these are hugely important issues.
This podcast series is a Fitzwilliam Museum, Carnegie Foundation and Athena Art Foundation co-production.